Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Today, Marvel goes miniature in superhero sequel Ant-Man and the Wasp. Is it Antastic or B-grade?
Guys, come on, man! We got bigger fish to fry!
Then, Gemma Arterton is a woman on the verge of a breakdown in British domestic drama, The Escape.
I think I need to, like, get out and do something with my life.
Yeah, great.
Can I have a ticket to Paris, please?
Is that one way or return?
One way.
And there's a touring Agnès Varda retrospective doing the rounds this week. So for Film Club, we're revisiting the French icon's 1962 new wave classic, Cleo from 5 to 7. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yes, it's Michael Leader here in the host's chair. And this week we have two newcomers. I'd like to welcome Ella Kemp.
Hello.
And Kelly Weston.
Hi there.
So as you're both newcomers, could you please tell us a little bit about yourselves, Ella?
Thank you very much, Michael. I am a freelance film critic. I write for Little White Lies, for Sight and Sound, for Days sometimes, and I'm the incoming cinema editor at Culture Whisper.
Oh, fantastic. And Kelly?
Yes, same. I am a contributing writer to Sight and Sound and also The Skinny.
Oh, brilliant. So we'll have to get The Skinny on your opinions on the films this week shortly. But first, a little bit of follow-up from last week. We were talking about Tom Cruise and his history with facial hair in the films. And John McGovern and Matthew McConaughey on Twitter rightly put us in our place and immediately tweeted at us saying that Tom Cruise had a moustache in Born on the 4th of July. And, of course, beards in Tropic Thunder, Collateral and The Last Samurai. I guess if there are any other important facial fuzz business, you could send us an email at truthandmovies@tcolondon.com, at LWLies on Twitter, or in the comments field on lwlies.com/podcast. I think that's enough about Tom Cruise this week. We got enough of that last week. So let's...
He's doing fine.
He'll be back soon.
He'll be back before you know it. So let's crack on with our first film this week, Ant-Man and the Wasp. So after the events of Civil War, Scott Lang is under house arrest for joining forces with Captain America, but he soon crosses paths once more with Hank Pym and his daughter Hope, who's now operating as the Wasp. They want to dive deep into the quantum realm to rescue Hope's mother, but Scott has problems of his own, not least his ramshackle security firm, headed up by his motor-mouth pal Luis, played by Michael Peña.
Help yourself.
Hey, what's up with the fancy pastry? We gotta keep the food budget down.
Well, what are we supposed to have for breakfast?
The oatmeal packets.
Oatmeal packets.
It's insult.
Why is it an insult?
Because it tastes like sand.
You know why? It's because it's organic.
No, that's it's not organic. It's sand.
It's the most important meal of the day.
You know what? You can get creative with it.
Break teeth.
I'll put a little brown sugar on it. You put some cinnamon. Put a little honey.
Guys, come on, man. We got bigger fish to fry.
Is that my desk?
Yeah.
What? Why do I have such a small desk?
Well, because you weren't there when we were choosing desks.
You snooze, you lose.
Well, I was under house arrest.
Yeah.
You know what? This isn't even a desk. This is garbage. You found this outside amongst garbage.
I got it at a rummage sale.
So you save money on my desk?
Guys!
Hope, please. We need to focus, all right? We gotta find that lab already. Jeez!
So there's a clip from Ant-Man and the Wasp, the 20th Marvel movie, and the first after the event of Infinity War earlier this year. So, Kelly, are you a Marvel fan? Were you excited for this one?
I don't self-identify as a Marvel fan, but I probably am. I do generally go see those films, even though I'm not a huge comic book fan. I loved Black Panther. I unexpectedly really liked Avengers: Infinity War, despite having not seen all of the films of all of the superheroes that were in that film. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that one of the things that Ant-Man and the Wasp suffers from is coming out after films like Black Panther, which is really epic and grand in scale, and also Infinity War. And you also, I think, have to orient yourself when you first start watching Ant-Man and the Wasp, because we're not sure, you know, I don't know how many people have seen Infinity War.
I think everyone
at this
in the world has seen it now.
I think we can safely say that some of our superheroes are MIA. We don't know where they've gone. And so it's just a bit confusing. And also because this film sort of deals with a lot more intimate issues, which is a good thing. It's more about friendship and family. It just doesn't have the same kind of scale as its predecessors.
Well, it's such a conscious gear shift down. You know, Black Panther and Infinity War were such massive scale movies, and this one is back on that human scale.
Exactly.
Kind of like the way that the first Ant-Man movie immediately came after, I think, Age of Ultron, or at least another one of those massive movies, and is a conscious shift down in scale to a human level thing. Ella, were you a fan of that first film? Were you excited going into this one?
I appreciated the first film. I did think it also felt like it was on quite a small scale. But I ended up enjoying the second one much more than I thought, and much more than the first one, because I quite enjoyed the human scale, and it was all quite straightforward, and you understand why you had to care and why they cared. And it wasn't epic at all. It wasn't too over the top, but I felt like it gave me enough to engage with, and I found it quite enjoyable.
I definitely like this film a lot more than the first Ant-Man. I think that this film was just a bit tighter, even though I think, I mean, we'll get into this I think in a second. I think there were just way too many characters. There were a little bit too many plot lines going on. I really think they should have spent more time developing Ghost, who is the primary antagonist in this film. And at the same time as Scott and Hope and Hank Pym, played by Michael Douglas, are trying to get their lab back from Ghost, who needs it for her own reasons, which we won't get into for fear of spoilers, Walton Goggins is also trying to get the lab, and he has his own, you know, cronies. And it's, to me, I think Walton Goggins is always welcome. Love a bit of Goggins. But he didn't need to be in this film as much. I think I would have been happy with setting him up for something in the long term, and then spending more time developing Ghost as a really solid foil to Hope Van Dyne, who is the new Wasp. And because Ghost also has a... There's a more succinct way to say this.
It's a complicated movie,
isn't it? This is what I mean. There's so much going on. Perhaps I'll start there. There's really a lot going on, but Ghost, who's played by Hannah John Kamen, I think it's probably pronounced her name, who's beautiful, a really incredible actress. She, in this film, is really set up, I think, to be a quite interesting villain, but they never do quite enough with her. She has an adoptive father in the film. We won't say who that is, but they don't really develop that relationship between the two of them. And I think that would have been so interesting to juxtapose their relationship with Hank and Hope's.
Well, this is what's so interesting about this film. We say it's this gear shift away from the epic scale of Infinity War, but it has a sort of sequel bloat. So it follows on from the last Ant-Man, where Paul Rudd is a sort of a hapless dad. You know, he has a young daughter, and his ex-wife is now shacked up with somebody else. So he has that to deal with, plus the fact that he's now an ex-con, so he's under house arrest and has the FBI on his case, as well as this love-hate relationship with both Hank Pym and Hope Van Dyne. And then they are a keyhole into this world of absolute sci-fi babble of going into the quantum realm and moving in the space between atoms.
And molecular structures. Yeah. There's a lot of talk
where they just talk very, very quickly, almost hoping that you won't understand, to saying, okay, if we condense everything to do with what we're actually doing, maybe the audience will just look at the colours of the quantum realm and still be into it.
Well, what I like is that it's pure 1950s sci-fi.
Oh, it looks lovely. You know?
It looks
gorgeous,
very
but it's
trippy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But then also, this is probably the most immediately entertaining sort of Marvel movie. It's a straight-up comedy. You have Paul Rudd bringing that sort of humour that you'd expect, and still that same interplay with Michael Peña's character,
yes.
the fact
yeah.
that he runs on these long anecdotes. Mm. Another highlight of the movie is one of those.
I think one of the film's strengths is its charm. Like, there's no one in this cast that you don't love.
But it feels very specific to this cast as well. Like, as soon as Paul Rudd started being funny, I felt that it was very specific to him, and I thought, well, of course, thank God Paul Rudd is in this. I'm therefore there is a reason for me to watch it, and I'm really enjoying it.
I also just think it's important to note that Paul Rudd looks amazing this film.
He
I
really
think that
does.
Is that has not been said enough in
no.
the critical
it's true.
spectrum. Yeah. He looks great in this.
He just keeps getting better and better with age.
He does.
Yeah, exactly.
But everything does look great, because I think that is also to do with their powers and the suits, and it feels like it really plays on the specificities of the power as opposed to just being, I can go small so that I can stop this bad thing from happening. Mm. They just really play around a lot with the effects of the suits and the power, which they didn't as much before.
They did have one or two set pieces in that first one, but they just throw
more
in there.
Yeah, it didn't feel like it was as much. And here it felt like from the beginning you had this big fight at one point where they really played around with it, but then you didn't lose it throughout.
Well, it's the idea that once they introduce the idea that it's not just the heroes that can shrink themselves or enlarge themselves, they can make other things shrink and grow. So there's a kitchen fight sequence, for example, where the wasp is sort of enlarging a salt and pepper shaker or whatever. But there's also, I believe it's in the trailer, so it's not much of a spoiler, but the fact that we're talking about trying to get their lab back from all these people who are trying to steal their lab is the fact that it's an entire sort of tower block building that they shrink down to the size of a carry-on case on a flight.
Which has its own handle as well that extends every time.
So it's literally an ultra-high-tech lab that can be wheeled around by various people. So.
But on that note, I also think that the conflict isn't as well-structured as it should be. Perhaps I missed this. Maybe I shouldn't say this as a critic, but we're never really quite sure why Walton Goggins wants the lab. Like
He has shady buyers in the background.
He's an arms dealer. He's a black market arms dealer. Yeah. And he wants to get the lab for his own reasons, and we have no idea what he's going to do with them, but so we don't really
have his own spin-off. He should have just been teased at the end.
Absolutely.
Kind of looking at the lab like, oh, this could be interesting for me, and then you have this kind of slapstick theme tune for him,
right,
for his own thing. That would
right.
be great.
And so occasionally, you know, Walton Goggins doesn't have any superpowers or anything. So
that we know of.
That we know of. You have to wait for Ant-Man 3, Ant-Man the Wasp, and Sonny.
Rolls off the tongue, really.
But also, there are so many instances throughout the film where it's like they make it time sensitive. Mm-hmm. And so it feels like they didn't really think very deeply about all of the dilemmas or all of the stakes. So it's like, you know, we have to get Michelle Pfeiffer within this particular time frame or you'll never see her again. And then Hannah John Cannon's character, Ghost, must be saved within this particular time, within 2 weeks, or she's going to die forever. And it's never really explained why. Mm-hmm. We're just supposed to just sort of go along with it. And so I think the film maybe suffered a bit from too many screenwriters. There are no less than five, including Paul Rudd.
Exactly. But I imagine his input into the screenplay is probably what's best about that. This feeling of chemistry in between characters and actors. This just
And making it all feel easier as well. I feel like Paul Rudd's inclusion makes it less complicated, and it's less about the quantum realm and more about the charm of the characters.
Well, the very first scene of the movie is him on house arrest trying to form a bond with his daughter by creating these incredible mini heists within their attic. And there are some great bits of dialogue in there. You know, personally, as a fan of the franchise, I like to see where it was becoming self-aware. So he'd be talking to Evangeline Lilly's character, I believe it was at the time, where he says, oh, Cap called me and wants me to go and join Cap. And she's like, Cap? Like, call him? And, you know, after these films where a lot of the trappings of the superhero franchise has become kind of written as solid canon, it's good to have that little step back and realise that this is kind of weird and silly.
Well, it's nice that it's self-aware and there is this nod to the Avengers, but without it feeling too tied down to the tragedy that has occurred so many times.
Well, Kelly, you did say when you sat down to watch the film, you weren't sure where this will land in that chronology. technology, mm-hmm. and it benefits from being set specifically before Infinity
right.
War.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the events of that don't have an immediate impact on the film as mm-hmm. you see it. But it does, I think it ties together into the larger franchise
yeah.
so well.
Yeah, it does so very nicely. And I think it also handles its tone really mm-hmm. well, which I think mm-hmm. is something that Thor, which I would say is probably its cousin in a sense, mm-hmm. in terms of how funny it is, having a charming cast, and not being quite as serious as some of the other mm-hmm. Films in any case. And to me, it definitely benefits from those close relationships. So, you know, we were saying that in one sense, it is a shame that it came after all of these big grand movies, but it's also really heartwarming to see these friendships, these familial mm-hmm. bonds. There's something about it that's really endearing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how the film is not very self-conscious about that. It's not trying to, you know, Scott Lang doesn't have to save the world. He's trying to save his friends.
And he's selfish, but
in a
good way, in mm-hmm. a way that you would also be selfish if you or your children, family, mm-hmm. friends, whichever, were
he's
in danger.
Human.
Yeah. Well, it gets back to what some saw as the key ingredient for why Marvel films and comics were so successful, because mm-hmm. it's their human characters. Mm-hmm. This is closer in spirit in some ways to a Spider-Man movie,
right.
where
yeah.
really it's just about helping your family, helping your friends,
right.
than saving the world.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't have as much sort of visual flair or stakes or great set piece sequences as the first one, I think that it still has plenty here and it's quite solidly enjoyable,
yeah.
I think. And also, I think you skirted around his inclusion in the cast, but he is a cast member. Lawrence Fishburne is in this.
Yes.
One of my favourite actors.
Same.
And it's great to see him in this sort of movie. Mm-hmm. He plays a sort of an old colleague of Hank Pym's,
mm-hmm.
and he comes on the scene. There's actually a brilliant scene of him in de-aged makeup. And it's just like late 80s
so
Lawrence Fishburne walks on the screen.
So good.
The hair is very good. It's very believable.
Yeah.
yeah. And I think this is the first film, if I am not mistaken, that Lawrence Fishburne has been in with Michelle Pfeiffer
well,
and
I think
that whole
triangle.
Whole group. Yeah.
So you have mm-hmm. Michelle Pfeiffer here as Janet Van Dyne, the original Wasp,
mm-hmm.
and then Hank Pym played by Michael Lewis. None of those three, you know,
ever been in film
iconic
together.
Actors have been in the film together. So
and
they're all
so,
in here.
Yeah.
I think what touched me about this film, almost beyond all these immediate pleasures, is that title can just as much refer to the original Ant-Man and the Wasp, because it's Michael Douglas,
mm-hmm.
Hank Pym, trying to rescue his wife, his long-lost wife, from the Quantum Realm. And
it is also, apparently, if I'm not mistaken, the first Marvel film where a woman has been name-checked in the title.
With the title character.
Yeah.
Apart from, the Avengers is a team.
The Avengers is a team, yeah.
The
but you really feel
one.
That in the film as well, that equal billing. I think before going into the film, I'd almost roll my eyes a bit thinking Ant-Man and this new sidekick for a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
But then watching the whole film, I think the Wasp
They're
is
partners.
As important,
yeah.
more exciting at
she
some
has
points
her whole,
as well.
She has her individual story to,
yeah.
to
yeah.
explore.
And
tell.
She plays it so well. Evangeline Lilly is brilliant. And
she's great.
Yeah, she just carries the powers, her character, the relationship with Scott, with her father, with everyone, just really brilliantly. And I didn't necessarily expect that. You'd think it would more be about Paul Rudd just carrying the film again and then some other people get involved as well. But he doesn't take a back seat, but he definitely makes room for other people to really step up, and I think it really works.
And that might have contributed a little bit to why the film feels a little overbloated, because they really do try to give every character a reason to be there,
yeah.
and have a moment and a through line.
There's more interesting characters.
Yeah, but it's pretty good. Let's throw some scores at this film then. Kelly, do you want to say your in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect for this?
In anticipation, I'm sorry, it would have to be a one. It would have to be a one. And then, was it in anticipation?
Enjoyment.
I would give it a 3.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it. I definitely think it has a few too many characters, but I would watch it again. So I give it, in retrospect, another 3.
Mm.
Yeah.
Ella?
I think I would give it a 2 in anticipation, maybe for my 1 in anticipation from the first one, plus another 1 for the sequel. In enjoyment, I really had a good time. I think I'd give it a 4.
Mm-hmm.
I love the effects. I love the characters. I was into it. In retrospect, I'm going to stick with a 4. Okay. You haven't dissuaded me, Kelly. I enjoyed it a lot.
Well, for my part, I'm always going to be in the front row for these films. So, and this was one of the best ones of the previous phase. So for the Ant-Man sequel, I have probably a 4 in anticipation. I thought it was solidly enjoyable, probably a strong 3 in enjoyment. And if it diminishes slightly in retrospect, it would still be a 3 for me. Mm. I think this is a great addition to the franchise. Mm-hmm. And it's good to have the Marvel Cinematic Universe have these gear shifts between the big and the small, and ones mm-hmm. you can just enjoy on on the background on your TV versus the one that you have to watch every minute for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was Ant-Man and the Wasp in cinemas now, only a month after America had the chance to see it. Thank you to the World Cup. Up next, we're reviewing The Escape. So in The Escape, Gemma Arterton is Tara, a young mother of two experiencing a crisis as the daily grind starts to take its toll. Is there a way for her to fix her life and find happiness, or is it just too late? Here's a clip from the trailer.
I'm not happy.
Hey.
I'm not happy.
Come on, this ain't like you, is it? Sulking in the baby's room. Where's my happy girl?
It's a phase. It's just a phase. Everybody goes through it.
I envy you. No good with the kids. They hate me.
Shut up. You're a great mum.
I think I need to, like, get out and do something with my life.
Yeah, great.
Oh, can I have a ticket to Paris, please?
Is that one way or return?
One way.
Is this what you want? Is this what you care about?
I can't do this.
Let me go!
Being free and being married contradicts me.
So this is very much a sort of showcase film built around Gemma Arterton. Ella, are you a fan of Gemma Arterton? Do you think this is something she really needed, a showcase?
Well, I think it could have been great for her to have a big role, an exciting role, something that could potentially be a career-defining role. Mm-hmm. I think that's what it could have been.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was.
Right, okay.
I'm sad that it was not, for me, a career-defining role for Gemma Arterton. I don't think it's her fault. Mm-hmm. I think her performance is brilliant and it's really harrowing and sometimes quite difficult to watch. But I just think that the film around her, it's not enjoyable. It's difficult, but not in a way that makes you feel like it's satisfying because it's accurately pinpointing a lot of struggles and providing some kind of escape, solution, mm-hmm. whatever it might be. I felt like there were so many different strands going on and so much potential for things to move on mm-hmm. and for things to get better or worse for her. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of it, it just stagnated and things didn't really move. And when they did move, it was after such a weirdly long amount of time. And it just felt that like there were lots of loose ends that didn't really get resolved, mm-hmm. and if they did, it wasn't satisfying, and it felt like she didn't get what she deserved, the actor or the character.
The actor or the character. It's funny, I was just thinking whilst watching this, I like Gemma Arterton a lot. I think she's just such a charismatic, charming and talented
Absolutely.
Actress. You know, Byzantium, Neil Marshall's vampire drama is the one that I go back to, where it's her and Saoirse Ronan on the coast as vampires. Mm. Brilliant. But then also Gemma Bovary, Tamara Drew. I mean, if you want to go back to Strawberry Fields when she was in the Bond movie.
Right.
Quantum of Solace, I believe.
Her career trajectory is really interesting, especially when you compare her to her contemporaries. Mm-hmm. You know, the likes of Keira Knightley, Hayley Atwell, mm-hmm. who have made a different kind of impact. Mm-hmm. Because I do think she is really, really talented. I love watching her. And
I'm never worried when I see her build. I always think this could be really exciting.
Yeah.
And I'm ready to be really impressed.
And she gives it her all in this film. Mm-hmm. I think it's an incredible performance. It's much better than the film around her deserves.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, I think the film itself, just to, I guess, set it up a little bit more, she's married. She has two young children. She has a very ambivalent relationship with motherhood. Mm-hmm. Her relationship with her husband, played by Dominic Cooper, in this film is extremely troublesome.
It's really upsetting. There's so many sides of her life that are so upsetting. But I feel like everything is upsetting in a kind of 5 out of 10, I can see this getting worse. I can see this maybe getting better. But none of the strands get better or worse. You've got the side with her husband, you've got the side with her children, and also her life and things that she enjoys doing creatively, personally, on that
and
kind of
thing. And
it all
just seems to be there. It's just quite maudlin. Like, it's just there to, you know, make us cry. The film sort of opens with this very overwrought music and
which
close
doesn't
up
leave.
Which
never
doesn't
leaves.
Leave. And you know something's, you know, some tears are about to come because the music just starts. So you know, it's just like, prepare to be sad because she's sad, but it never actually gets to the heart of her claustrophobia.
It really wants to try and get inside her head.
Yeah.
You know, the way it's filmed by director Dominic Savage is so up close and handheld, very shallow focus, lots of extreme close-ups of her face as she's having these crisis, you know, moments of crisis, depressive episodes, ennui, whatever it could be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really yearning to put you in her shoes to see her, that crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And Gemma Arterton is, you know, performing so well,
she
technically.
Sells it.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah, I believe her, but the film doesn't give her that complexity. Like, we're just sort of meant to intuit a lot of it. And I don't think that's fair. You know, we don't really know, like, what kind of person she was before she got married that makes her so untethered to this, or just desire to be so untethered to this life.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, she's a scene with her mother where her mother's telling her mother comes from clearly, you know, a lower middle class or working class background. And she says to her, you know, you have two cars, you have a conservatory, should be happy.
Yeah.
And the fact is, you know, those things don't make people happy.
Right.
But the audience is thinking, yeah, she should be happy. We don't really understand exactly what it is.
But also, it's not really a revelation that, you know, having a nice house and cars and so on makes people happy. You know, it's
exactly,
not necessarily novel or treading new ground.
Yeah.
But it's frustrating that she's not given more dialogue to say
what she thinks
to anyone who's not her husband, who doesn't listen to her and doesn't really seem to listen to anyone or anything. Her mum, who is telling her that she has a conservatory, and like, she doesn't have friends or relationships that she can say anything to.
That probably feeds into something about the way the film was made. It was mostly improvised, so that the scenes would have maybe beginnings and ends, but then they just find their way there. So that might be something about that written depth that you might expect from something like
but
this.
There's no setup for her to blossom or confess or just develop as a character outside of the strenuous relationships and circumstances she has within her everyday life.
And I think it's, you know, you're right. Like, we all know that having two cars, having a nice house, all of these things, these luxurious things, don't necessarily make people happy. But then they treat her, you know, running off to Paris as if it does make her happy. And that's a very middle class solution, because if you are a working class mother, you don't necessarily have the funds to just, you know, jaunt off to Paris and stay in a fancy hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just, you can't really have it both ways, to me, especially if you're not going to explain what it is about this lifestyle that is so unsettling and oppressive to her.
And the pacing around the whole Paris event is so bizarre.
Yeah.
And just even with this, well, in the one line synopsis of the film, it says, an ordinary woman makes an extraordinary decision which will change her life forever. This extraordinary decision felt really anticlimactic.
Mm.
And I felt like it came at a very strange point in the film, and it didn't provide any kind of payoff or satisfaction or just any joy of seeing her there. And
it sort of falls awkwardly between multiple sort of dramatic genres. It's not really a full-blown melodrama because there's not the stakes there, the events don't happen.
Mm.
It's not really a social realist drama because it doesn't attack and scrutinise that sense of class and so on that you were talking about, Kelly.
Yeah.
But then also it doesn't really feed into these more sort of genre-fied explorations of modern-day motherhood like The Babadook or Tully from earlier this year.
Yeah.
But what this film does share with those are some incredible scenes of just kids being nightmarish, and the very concept of having children coming away from this film is almost like a horror movie.
Mm.
And there is just to talk about Gemma Arterton on a scene level, there is a scene where she does erupt at her kids and she puts the end of her tether. And it's a really, you know, almost a single moment from this film that you can highlight.
Mm.
And actually, Adam Woodward, he interviewed her very recently, Gemma Arterton, and asked her about that scene. And we have a clip from that interview.
It was the worst thing. This film was really challenging, but that was the most challenging scene because usually in life I'm really good with kids and like they love me and I play with them and I'm really silly with them. On this film, I started doing that and then I just couldn't because I had to do the, you know, the film. And because the camera was rolling all the time, I couldn't suddenly snap out of what I was doing. So the children started to not like me, and they tried to avoid me, and they'd run out of the room when I came into the room, and they'd start crying and things like that. And we knew in the treatment, there was this scene, she shouts at the children, and I was like, we can't do that until the very last day, with the, because after I've done that, they won't be in the room with me anymore. And it was really distressing. Actually, it was really interesting. The children had been playing up to that point, and when I shouted at them, they laughed. They were like, she's stressed out. But it was horrible. I mean, the little boy did cry, and I hated it. It was horrid. But it was, in a weird way, it kind of helped me, because that was actually the most distressing. Knowing that they didn't like me, they were afraid of me, was really horrible. And also because Dominic Cooper could come in and just muck about with them. And it was sort of almost like how it is in the film, you know. The kids came to Paris, which was the last stuff we shot. Then we don't see that in the film, but they did actually come, and they saw me, and the little girl hid behind the sofa and said, no, not her. I don't want to see her. And I just, oh, God, it was awful. But, you know, all for the love of art. I hope I haven't, traumatised them.
So that was Gemma Arterton there. Do we have any final comments about The Escape, Kelly?
Because we've been ragging on it, I do have one pro.
Okay.
I did think it was really interesting the way Savage filmed or sort of explored the disconnect between physical intimacy and emotional intimacy.
Right.
And I think that's something that doesn't get explored a lot in films, particularly in films about women and their relationships with men. I think physical intimacy is sort of filmed as if it is also, you know, simultaneously this sort of emotional connection, and it isn't always that. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated that being part of her story.
Well, particularly these sex scenes with Dominic Cooper, where it's so one-sided.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So should we wrap this up, put some scores on this? Ella, do you want to go first?
My anticipation was not really much higher than a 2, I'd say. Enjoyment, I'd go for a 2, because there was a lot of interesting potential with the varying levels of abuse that she had to go through. But in retrospect, it might have to be a 1. It didn't have a payoff.
Thanks.
I wasn't satisfied with anything that happened to her. She deserves better.
Same for me. Well, actually, anticipation, I think, would be a 1. But as a film, I do think it was compelling. I just think it never really comes to fruition, whatever it is they're trying to do with this. But Gemma Arterton is great in it, so I would give it a 2. And in retrospect, it's definitely a 1. I would not go back to this film.
Yeah, I think for me it's a 3-2-1. And the only positive things I can say about this are all related to Gemma Arterton, to be honest. You know, she's still one of my favourite actresses of her generation, and I will look forward to seeing her in more. So, like Gemma, we're going to escape to France for Film Club. This is Cleo from 5 to 7, directed by Agnes Varda.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
So this week, a new retrospective of the films of Agnes Varda is starting. It's called Gleaning Truths. It's a nationwide tour of 8 fiction and documentary films that she directed. You can find out more info at curzon.com/Agnes Varda. But we're going to start with her second feature, a landmark film from 1962 called Cleo from 5 to 7. It covers 2 hours in the life of a singer as she waits for test results from her doctor. It follows her through the streets of Paris from encounter to encounter. Kelly, this is quite a landmark film in her career and French cinema in general, isn't it?
Yeah. It came right after her debut, if I'm not mistaken, La Pointe Curte. Mm-hmm. I'm terrible at French, so sorry about that to French listeners and also my French friends listening. But it begins this sort of tradition of Varda, who really operates within social realism. It's about a woman who feels trapped in some way. And it's just a really compelling, still unfortunately quite relevant story about a woman who feels really pressured by society. There's so many references to the idea of looking, a woman looking at herself, their mask, the way that women sort of don masks. Mm-hmm. You know, really interesting film in general, but certainly easily to me, like, one of the most interesting films about women, period, even though this was 1960?
Early 60s, yeah.
Early 60s. And yeah, it's just great. I love it. I've seen it a couple of times. And yeah, you mean you can't get better than Varda.
It's funny what we were just saying about The Escape, this idea that we really wanted to more interiority. We wanted to get to know this character more, and that's exactly what this film is. It's so dense with feeling and insight and into the philosophy of her mind and her perspective and the way she is looked at and looks at the world.
Yeah.
Ella, did you have a relationship with this film before this, or was this a first watch for you?
So I actually watched it for the first time a few months ago and didn't really engage with it as much, but I really enjoyed watching it again because it allowed me to focus on detail so much more. So the script is just so effortlessly beautiful and existential, but in a way that still feels really light and just bounces from scene to scene while still being able to make you think about the gravity of everything that's being said. And that is something that's really different from The Escape, because I found that The Escape for the whole time just felt really heavy and harrowing without really giving me anything to actually think about afterwards. Whereas with Cleo, it's really light and just bouncy, and I found myself really enjoying it, but still consistently wondering about her and what she's thinking and about me and how every other woman that I know might react to these kind of situations. And it strikes this really special balance in allowing you to enjoy it without losing focus of really important issues.
Yeah, what I love about watching the films from this era is that there was still such a sense of experimentation and freedom. Mm-hmm. So Agnes Varda had made a few documentaries and one feature before this, but she was a photographer and she wasn't just a movie brat, as nearly all directors are now. And so she just throws conventions out the window and throws ideas almost on a scene-by-scene level into the melting pot. You know, the opening title sequence is in colour, the rest of the film is in black and white. You have jump cuts, you have these beautiful, almost documentary-like street photography sequences just on Paris streets of amazing faces of just ordinary people. And it just feels like a film that is organically existing in front of your eyes. And then this structural idea of it being, it's not fully in real time because the film is an hour and a half and isn't for 2 hours, but it feels like you're just following her on her way throughout her day. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting.
Varda is really one of the most crucial directors of the French New Wave, and even though she actually predecessed it. So La Pointe Curte, if I'm not mistaken, came out actually a couple of years before we think of that era.
Yeah, so with Jean-Luc Godard and François Truffaut, etc.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting what you say, Ella, about it being quite light and bouncy in many ways, because the context of this film is the Algerian War, which is not light and bouncy, famously. And she meets a soldier who is fighting in that war at the end of the film. This was a time when a lot of African countries were gaining their independence from France. It was a colonial power. And the way that, you know, is integrated into the film is really sensitive, I think, without sort of marrying this woman who is a famous singer, who's very glamorous, without marrying those two ideas, it's just very much used as a kind of structure to explore all the many ways that society goes about marginalizing people. Mm. And in the hands of a less capable director, I think it would have been easy for the film to sort of mirror these two situations. But it doesn't. It's just her trying to exist in this world, moving through it. Because there's actually a scene where she's in a taxi and she sees in the window these masks which have a kind of, like, African right. look to them. But, you know, she's dealing with something quite different. You know, she's worrying. She's quite superstitious, but she's also in the back of her mind thinking about the results of this biopsy. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate that. You know, it's 1962, so you just kind of wouldn't expect that. But I was really struck by that. I was struck mm-hmm. by how those two things just weren't... They were integrated in such a way that it didn't make me feel as though Varda was trying to equate the two problems.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's got this this wonderful to and fro with the specific and the general, this sort of the present and the yes. the past, and something that I like going back. And I watched this film when I was at university, maybe a decade ago now, and I rewatch it now, and it has almost perfect little moments that talk about catcalling, that talk about mansplaining. Mm. There's a beautiful bit where Antoine, who actually turns into sort of her partner for the film at the end, he just turns up and just starts blabbing at her, and she says, "Men wait for all women; they approach them and talk."
Yeah,
and it's like Agnes Varda just captured mansplaining there 50 years ago, 60 years ago,
and just everything feels so natural instead of feeling like I'm going to make a film about mansplaining or about this problem or about this problem. It's just been done, and there's just this instinct about it that is right about things that are wrong. Yeah. And it just feels so refreshing. And even things about oneself, I think, are done in such an interesting way. Like, there's so much about the idea of vanity and beauty and the way you look at yourself and kind of the difference between pride and beauty and all sorts.
And how that in and of itself sort of infects you in a way, because she's thinking about the, you know, whether or not she has cancer. But she is also really very much destroyed by this idea of what people think or see when they look at her.
And how that will make her look
exactly.
if she does or doesn't have cancer.
Because she has there's a line where she says essentially, you know, her cancer may be pancreatic, I think. So she says, it's in my stomach. And her friend she says something to her friend where it's like, at least people can't see it there. Mm-hmm. And there's something so affecting about that line.
And what her friend says in response. So her friend who's just finished a
sculpting class.
As a life model. And in response to that, she says, so I think Cleo is kind of questioning why she does it and whether she enjoys it. And her friend says, my body makes me happy, not proud.
Yeah.
And I just think that's the thing you just never think about. And Agnes Varda's just put that line in
just
there.
Just dropped it in there.
Yeah. Just like, I'm going to let you think about this now.
And then before you know it, they're off to another, they're having some
somewhere
other business
else
going
in
on.
Paris.
In fact, literally 2 minutes after that, they have a film within a film, which is a sort of pastiche of perspective, but also making a joke about a guy who always wears sunglasses when he's eating. And
that's so interesting. Because, you know, it is a film about duality and about, you know, having two faces, essentially. So at the end, or near the end, rather, we learn that Cleo is her stage name. Mm-hmm. Her real name is Florence. And then she's talking to Antoine, the soldier she meets. And he basically tells her, you know, I like your real name. I like Florence better. Because that's, you know, the real you. And Varda plays with that in so many different ways with the way that Cleo dresses. You know, when she goes out for the second time in the film, she takes off this very glamorous polka dot dress that she has on, and she puts on this very simple black dress, and she takes off her wig. And just really small things like that, I think, really make this film that it's just not glaring. I really enjoy the subtlety of it, whilst because it's just so quietly affecting. You know, she's not very loud about how oppressive it is. It's just, you can see it in everything, in the way that women move, in the way that women think about themselves, in the way that women dress. It's really beautiful.
I think we like this film.
Yes,
we do.
We're fans.
I think we'd recommend it as well. I think really just what a terrific movie in miniature as a whole. You'll get so much from it. But then it's part of this touring season. Is there another Varda film that we may recommend? I've only seen two of her films. So this one and Faces Places, which hasn't actually come out yet. It's coming out later this year. But that's a documentary. It's a very different sort of film to this. But there is this touring season of eight. Kelly, do you have one in there that you may recommend?
I really would recommend Le Bonheur. Right. I don't know if that's showing
it is
in
part
the,
of the season.
Yeah, great. Okay. I recommend Le Bonheur. That was the first Varda film that I ever saw. It still haunts me to this day.
Is that fiction or documentary? Because she
fiction.
Does both,
it's,
right?
Exactly. And I would also recommend, definitely recommend Faces Places and also Beaches of Agnes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And yeah, Le Bonheur is a fiction film. I think it came out shortly after this film, but it's essentially about the marriage between this man and this woman. He falls in love with another woman and takes her as a mistress. Right. And I won't give away the ending, but it's just harrowing. So watch that and have your emotions ruined. Yeah.
Have you seen many of these Agnes Varda films, Ella?
So Le Bonheur is the only other one that I've seen for now as well. I'm very much looking forward. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it again and discovering all of the others that I have to catch up on, but I think what better way than on the big screen in
exactly.
the upcoming season.
And I'll just make one more mention of Faces Places, or as they call it in France, Visage Village. It's
that
so rare
correct.
That we would have rhyming puns titles in both languages. I'm so excited. But yes, you can find more information about this touring season at curzon.com/Agnes Varda. In fact, there are all sorts of goodies up there. There's essays and videos and so on. We recommend you check that out. And really now it's just a bit of wrap-up. In fact, actually, we need to shout out two upcoming Little White Lies events at Somerset House coming up this month. There's a panel discussion on the art of discovering movies that Little White Lies are doing a movie. That's on the 16th of August. And Kelly, you're on the panel for that.
I am. I'll be talking about how little Kelly came to movies, how he became such a nerd about films. So come for more ramblings from me.
Brilliant anecdotes from the origin story of Kelly. Yeah. And then on the 22nd, we're recording a live episode of this very podcast at Somerset House. More info TBC about that. Tickets available as well from the Somerset House website. There's also a new issue that's just been announced for Little White Lies.
Beautiful new issue.
Beautiful new issue, gorgeous. As they always are. But this is all about the miseducation of Cameron Post, Desiree Akhavan's new film. It has a zine theme in the design and is packed with the usual reviews and features that you can expect from the magazine. That's more information about that at lwlies.com. And so next week, we're talking about a really massive shark called the Meg with Jason Statham taking it down. Was he making friends with it? I don't know. He's probably taking it down, right?
Well, the tagline is chomp on this, so doesn't seem friendly.
Okay, so we'll be chomping on that. We'll also be talking about the Paraguayan drama The Heiresses, which won Best Actress at the Berlin Film Festival earlier this year. And we'll be celebrating the 30th anniversary of Heathers, the dark high school comedy starring Winona Ryder and Christian Slater. That's our film club pick for next week, so let us know what you think at LWLies on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email, or on the comments section of lwlies.com/podcast. So it just leaves me to say thank you to Ella for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Where can we find more of your work or more of you?
You can find me on Twitter at EFEKemp. And various ramblings on Culture Whisper, Little White Lies, Sight and Sound, As and When.
And Kelly?
Yes, you can find me on Twitter at Kelly, that's Kelly with an I, K-E-L-L-I, Weston, also known as my Cyril Woodcock Stan account, from Phantom Thread, if you've seen the best movie of the year. And you can find me rambling away on The Skinny and Sight and Sound.
Terrific. Thank you so much to you both for joining me this week.
Thank you very much.
I've been Michael Leader, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.